Parable of the Unjust Judge, the second talk in a series entitled Prayer and Perseverance, was presented by Ron Julian on August 27, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good morning. I told you last week that I'm in the middle of writing my thesis for the degree program that I'm in. I'm writing on two parables that people often connect together, and they're often seen as teaching that the way to get what you want from God is to be persistent in your prayers, to go over and over again and not take no for an answer, kind of, is the idea. The first of these parables we talked about last time, that was the parable of the friend at midnight. And I argued that in that parable, it's not really talking about persistence at all. This week, we'll look at the other parable, the parable of the unjust judge in Luke 18. This parable clearly is talking about persistence of some kind in prayer, but I would still maintain that Jesus' point is often misunderstood here, and that actually what this parable has to say is very important to us in a fundamental way. It's not just how to get what you want from God, but it's dealing with a much more fundamental issue of our faith. I'll make a comment. Last time, in looking at the parable of the friend at midnight, I said that there were three places where it seemed to me that the New American Standard translation was misleading and really needed to be corrected in order to see what's going on. So it's only fair to say in this week that there are several places where there are translation decisions that have to be made, and I'll try to briefly talk about those. But in this case, it has little effect on our understanding of the parable. In this case, I think you could read pretty much any translation of this parable, and if you look carefully at what Jesus is saying, you could see what it is he's getting at. Nothing is really riding that much on any particular part of the translation, which is always a nice thing. So let me start by reading. I'll read the New American Standard, Luke 18, verse 1. Now he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart, saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me legal protection from my opponent.' And for a while he was unwilling. But afterward he said to himself, 'Even though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection, lest by continually coming she wear me out.' And the Lord said, 'Hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night, and will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?'" So, you're probably familiar with whenever someone wants to make the point that the way to get our prayers answered is to ask and ask and ask again and not take no until God gives us what we want, it's fairly certain that this parable will be appealed to somewhere along the line. This is a very common way to use this parable, because it seems obvious when you look at it. You have a widow who keeps asking a judge for justice. In spite of the fact that he keeps turning her away, she keeps going back again and again. Eventually, this persistence wins her what she was asking for. We, therefore, should do the same with our request to God. If we have not gotten what we wanted, we should just keep going back until we do. As was true with the previous parable, however, it seems to me that although there is some truth to the picture that we just painted there, the way this gets applied has wildly misunderstood what it is that Jesus is getting at. In order to talk about the big picture here, what it is he's saying, I want to start out by looking at some of the details, and then we'll kind of put the picture together at the end. Let me just, this is my note of warning to you as we launch into this. I've been working very hard on this paper that I've been doing, which means that what you're about to see here is not me sitting down fresh to write a sermon. This is me taking my chapter in my academic paper and trying to craft it into a sermon quickly. So I'm trying to keep it not boring, but I'm not entirely sure I've succeeded along the way, because the hallmark of an academic paper is to be as boring as possible. So just hang on. Ultimately, my plan is to say something interesting in here, but just give me a few minutes to get there. Okay. So let's start by talking about the context in which we find this this parable. Several commentators point out that it starts out by saying he spoke a parable to them. And who is them? It's not indicated there who it is he's talking to. And the fact that it's not indicated might suggest that he's still talking to the same group that he was talking to in Luke 17, that is, the disciples. And so it may be that there's a connection, that this parable is in fact continuing on with a theme that comes from the chapter before. And in the chapter before, Jesus is talking to his disciples about the coming of the kingdom of God and the Son of Man. And in particular, he says to his disciples, "The days shall come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it." That's in Luke 17, 22. "You will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. One day, at a time unknown, the Son of Man will return, bringing salvation to some and judgment to others." So, is our parable a part of that context about the coming of the Son of Man? Well, it's interesting to notice that the parable ends with the statement, "However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?" It's interesting that before the parable, he's talking about the coming of the Son of Man, and at the end of the parable, he's talking about the coming of the Son of Man. So it would seem to suggest that that may, in fact, be the relevant context in which to understand this. And I think that's right. As we'll see in the end, that's crucially important. Many people interpret this parable sort of taking that last statement as being tacked on in the end and sort of irrelevant to what it is that Jesus is saying. But actually, I think it's central. The whole point that he's getting at comes home when he talks about the coming of the Son of Man. Okay, so let me talk about a few of the details that need to be sorted out. I'm going to try to pare this down and keep this short. This is the part where I had to go on and on in the paper, but I'm going to try not to do that here. One of the questions we face is, why did the judge give the answer yes, finally? The New American Standard translates it, "lest she wear me out." And basically, let me just tell you, we have these three options for how to understand what he's saying there. Literally, the word means to punch somebody in the eye and give them a black eye. I mean, it's to hit them under the eye and give them a black eye. That's what this word means. When you look at it, the examples we have, and we don't have a lot of them, that's what it means. So one possibility is the judge is afraid, literally, that the widow is going to get so mad that she's going to hit him in the face. Okay? Is that plausible? I don't know. The advantage it has is that that's what the word means. So to take it that way is real simple. The word means to punch him in the eye, give him a black eye, and so he's afraid she's going to punch him in the eye. Option number two is what we see in the New American Standard. The judge is afraid that the widow is going to annoy him by her repeated coming. This is going to get so wearisome if she keeps coming back and back. It translates it, lest she wear me out, or some suggested, you know, give me a headache or something like that. And this is quite plausible in the context, and the only problem is that there's no evidence anywhere of this word being used to mean anything like that. And then the third possibility is that the judge is afraid that she is going to ruin his reputation, that she's going to shame him. There is a Semitic expression, not Greek, but Semitic expression. To blacken someone's face means to bring shame on them, to ruin their reputation. And the argument is made, well, maybe this is looking back to that. So we have this choice. In the end, it doesn't make a lot of difference. But we kind of have two kinds of things he's talking about. Either he's concerned that somehow she's going to bother him. She's going to literally hit him, or it's going to be irritating. Or else he's concerned about his reputation, that she's going to ultimately ruin his reputation. Which way to go is hard to say, I think. If I had to vote right now, I'm leaning 50.5% towards the reputation one, but it's very hard to be definitive. Okay, so there's another important phrase that I wanted to mention briefly. Jesus, in his explanation, after he tells the story, he says, "Shall not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry to him day and night? And then, and will he delay long over them?" There's a ton of stuff written about this phrase, because there's a lot of different ways you could take it. It's actually difficult to know exactly what Jesus is doing here. Let me just give you some of the possible ways that this could be understood, and don't bother to try to remember them, but just let me give you an idea of the kind of problem we face here. "Shall not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry to him day and night? And will he delay concerning his chosen ones? Or, and will he withhold his wrath from their adversaries? Or, even though he tarries concerning his chosen ones? Or, while he withholds his wrath graciously from his chosen ones? Or, while he withholds his wrath temporarily from their adversaries?" I mean, there's a lot of different permutations that you can put together here. The idea is basically one of being patient, but who's he being patient with? And is it saying he's not being patient, meaning he's not going to delay, or he is being patient, meaning he's going to wait a while? It's hard to answer the question. If this doesn't take up too much time, I thought there was an interesting thing I came across in studying this that I thought I would share with you. There is a passage in a book in the Apocrypha. The book is sometimes referred to as Ecclesiasticus, or The Wisdom of Jesus ben Sirach. And there's a passage in that that has a number of elements that are very similar to this parable that we have in Luke. The passage is about God's people crying out to him for justice, for vindication from their enemies. In it, God is a righteous judge who does not show partiality. He listens to the prayers of the widow. He sees her tears as she cries out against the one who is giving her trouble. God's people keep praying, and they don't give up until their prayers reach heaven. God responds to their prayers and grants them vindication from their enemies. And most importantly, there's this phrase in it that says, "And the Lord will not delay, neither will he be patient concerning them, until he repays vengeance on the nations, till he judges the case of his people." Okay, so the interesting thing is that it's this exact same phrase that we have in our passage, the one, "neither will he be patient concerning them." It's the same phrase, basically, that we have in the parable. And in the passage in Ecclesiasticus, it is clearer what it is that it means there than it is in our passage in Luke. So if we were to suppose, which is by no means certain, but if we were to suppose that Jesus is actually familiar with this passage, I'm sure he would have been familiar with it, but that he actually, in his mind, was drawing on the elements of it as he put together his parable, and the number of places where there are parallels suggest that that might not be a bad idea. That might be what he did. If that's true, then we could use the passage in Ecclesiasticus to narrow down the focus a little bit on what it is that Jesus is saying. And then the result of all of that, I think, is to say that the New American Standard translation, "will he delay long over them," may not be a bad idea, that that may actually be the best choice out of all of the options that we've got. Again, it's a judgment call. And ultimately, I don't think it affects how we understand the ultimate point all that much. But I thought that connection between the two passages was interesting. Okay, there's one other ambiguous phrase I wanted to talk about, and it's more the theology behind this that I think is interesting. Jesus says, I tell you, he will bring about justice for them speedily. This word speedily could be understood, however, to mean something more like suddenly. And why do we care whether it's quickly or suddenly? Well, because we have this problem here. This is a parable about answers that seem a long time in coming. There is a judge who says no for quite a while. It starts out with an encouragement not to lose heart. Keep on praying and don't lose heart. And there's this hint that Jesus may be so long in coming back that no one will be left expecting him. So for Jesus to say that God will answer our prayers for justice quickly seems like he may be saying too much. He's promising something that doesn't seem to be working out that way. So some would argue that suddenly is the better translation, because what he's saying is when he gets around to it, it'll be quick. But I think quickly is the way to understand it. And the passage that I've always looked to as a model for how to understand this comes from Habakkuk 2:3, where it reads, now Habakkuk, God is talking to Habakkuk about, he is giving him a vision, a prophecy concerning the future. This is what I'm going to do. Ultimately, this is how it's going to work out. But he says to him, for the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it will certainly come. It will not delay. And the interesting thing in that passage is that he says, on the one hand, though it tarries, it will not delay. And the question arises, well, is there a big difference between tarrying and delaying? Doesn't seem to be. And yet, there is this distinction that God is making. It may tarry, but it's not going to delay. And I think that's the kind of thing that we see in what Jesus is saying here. What God is saying in Habakkuk, I think, is what he has promised in the vision may tarry, in the sense that from our perspective, it may seem to us as if it is a long time in coming, and we may wonder whether it will ever arrive. I mean, this is what Habakkuk is being warned. You need to hang on. You need to expectantly wait for the fulfillment of what I'm talking about. But though it may tarry, it will not delay. That is, there is nothing hindering it, and God will not wait one second longer than is necessary to accomplish all his purposes. He's not being deliberately mean or withholding things just to take a long time. It is on schedule, and it is coming, and it will not fail, as he said. So I think what Jesus is suggesting here is along the same lines. This parable is dealing with the problem. How do we face the reality that we do not get an immediate answer to what we're crying out for? And what he's saying is basically, okay, you may have to wait, but it is not going to delay. God is going to come right on time with the answer to what you're crying out to him for. Okay. One other thing that's probably worth talking about here, and this is something that we're probably not used to thinking about and probably deserves more comment than I'm going to give it, but since in a very real sense our hope as Christians is that we will not receive justice, I mean, what I am looking for from God is not justice but mercy. If I get justice, I will be in trouble. What I'm looking for is mercy. So how then shall we understand that in this parable, Jesus in his explanation says, God's people are crying out to him for justice. Literally, it's a word that means something like vindication or revenge, to be avenged for the things that have been done. How are we to understand that? How are we to put that together? Well, I just have a couple of comments. However we put it together, we need to leave room in our understanding of our dealing with God for both the concept of mercy and justice. I mean, there is a sense in which we as God's people are looking at the way things are in the world and saying, this is not right. Something needs to be done. These people are triumphing in their evil and hurting and destroying the lives of many people. Something ought to be done. Something needs to happen. They ought to pay for that, one way or the other. Well, this is a theme that we see in the New Testament. Paul in Romans 12 says, "Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." Paul doesn't say, "Never take your own revenge," because it is never appropriate for justice to be done for anyone ever. What he says is, it is up to God ultimately to deal out justice, and he will. And the word that Paul's using here is the same word that Jesus is talking about. What we are calling out to God for is what's translated in this as vengeance, or to be avenged, for the rights to be wronged, for the wrongs to be righted, rather. That didn't turn out right. Okay. So ultimately what we're looking to from God is that he will deal with what is wrong, terribly wrong in the world, and make it right. And there will be those who come to him for mercy and will find it, and those who do not come to him for mercy will find justice instead. This is a part of the Christian hope, that day will come when God will finally deal out the fullness of his mercy and the fullness of his judgment so that things will be made right. The classic statement of this theme is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. "For after all, it is only just for God to repay with affliction those who afflict you, and to give relief to you who are afflicted, and to us as well, when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, dealing out retribution." And this is the word again that Jesus uses: justice, vengeance, retribution, "to those who do not know God and to those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. And these will pay the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power, when he comes to be glorified in his saints on that day and to be marveled at among all who have believed." It's hard for us because in our context now, for me to have a vindictive attitude towards someone would be a great spiritual disease. That is, for me to somehow feel like I'm superior to them and they need to get it but I don't, and that would be a bad thing. So it's hard for us to see that there is a spiritually healthy way to be avid for justice. That I'm not saying that I deserve any better than anyone else, but I am crying out for that day when God will be merciful on those to whom he will show mercy and ultimately take out of the way those who are evil and destroying the lives of the people around them. That's not a bad thing to want that. That's a good thing. It's just so easy for it to turn into a self-righteousness that is, in fact, a terrible thing. But it is, in fact, one of the great themes of the prophets, what we see here in the statement in 2 Thessalonians, that the Messiah, the Christ, when he comes, what he's going to do is establish justice on the earth. And you can find many, many examples of this, but I'll just give you one from Isaiah 42. "Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law." So it is, in fact, one of the strong themes of the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, that when the Messiah, the Christ, finally comes and establishes his kingdom, that justice will be done. And that's what we're looking for. Okay, so in the light of those various pieces, then, let's talk about the story. In a parable, I would argue that there are three questions to answer, because as I argued last week, a parable is basically an analogy, an extended analogy. Jesus is saying, this thing that we want to understand about the kingdom of God is like this other thing. And so that means that there are three questions to ask. What is happening in the story? First of all, the story about the widow and the judge. Do I understand what's happening and what everybody's feeling and thinking and so on? Then secondly, to what reality is the story analogous? What's the comparison being made? The widow and the judge and so forth are like what? And then thirdly, and most importantly, why are these two things like each other? Why is it that Jesus would say that somehow our situation before God is like this widow and this judge? So those are the three questions we want to talk about. First of all, what's happening in the story? I think Jesus wants us to put ourselves in the place of the widow and then to think about the response of the judge, that the response that he gives to her pleas. The basic turn of events is fairly easy to understand. A widow in that culture was in a very vulnerable position. One of the most common admonitions in the Old Testament was the need to uphold and not oppress the widows. A widow was the sort of person that a godly judge should be most concerned to protect. Anyone who knows the law of Moses at all would know that it is crucially important. A judge is supposed to pay attention to and deal fairly and give justice to the widows because they need protection. But this judge neither fears God nor has regard for man. There's a passage in 2 Chronicles 9 that gives advice to judges, and it makes clear how important the fear of God is. Consider what you do. For you judge not for man, but for the Lord. He is with you in giving judgment. Now then, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take heed what you do, for there is no perversion of justice with the Lord our God, or partiality, or taking bribes. Unfortunately, the widow is dealing with one of the other kind of judges, the kind of judges that has no interest in what 2 Chronicles has to say about anything. With the result that the judge doesn't care about justice, he doesn't care about what's right, and he doesn't care about her. The fact that she is in difficulty is not of concern to him. Perhaps her opponent is a powerful man. Perhaps the judge is waiting for a bribe that the widow can't pay. For whatever reason, there's nothing about her that interests her, and he has no interest in granting her the justice that she's looking for from her opponent. What is the widow to do? Well, Luke's opening words, where he explains that this is about keeping on praying and not losing heart, shows us one of the options that she would have. She could lose heart. She could give up. This judge keeps saying no. He's a creep. I should just give up. He's not going to say yes. But she doesn't quit. She keeps going back. Why should she quit? If she quits, then she will never get the justice that she needs. But if she keeps going back, hey, there's always a chance that the judge will end up changing his mind. What else can I do but keep going back? And sure enough, ultimately the judge decides to grant her request, even though he has no interest in her, he has no interest in what's right. Why does he do it? Like I said, either he's concerned about his reputation, or he's concerned that she's just turning into a great deal of trouble and he doesn't want to deal with her anymore. Okay, then, to what is the story analogous? What is being compared to this? That's not hard to see, up to a point. It's similar to that of the friend at midnight in this way. They're both analogies concerning petitionary prayer, going to God and asking him for something. The needy widow is comparable to us in our going to God and crying out to him for and justice. We'll talk about that in a second. And the judge is comparable to God. God is in the same position to us that the widow is to the judge, that the judge is to the widow. So in the explanation that Jesus gives following the story, he makes it clear that just as the widow was crying out for justice, so too we are crying out to God for justice. So that's another similarity between the stories. In both cases, we have someone crying out for justice, and the question is whether they'll get it. There are two somewhat shocking questions that arise from this analogy. This is one of them is one that has been commented on throughout the history of the church. Is Jesus really comparing God to an unrighteous judge? How does that work? I mean, why is he, does he have an unrighteous judge standing in the place of God in this story? And then a more subtle question, but an important one as well, is Jesus suggesting that our situation is like the widow in that we too keep being put off in our requests? And I would say that the answer to both of these questions is yes. That is true. That is another way in which this story is like our situation with God. And as we're going to see, basically, our cries to God for justice are still unanswered. So in that sense, we're like that widow. We face the question, what are we going to do? Okay, so that brings us, though, to that third question. Why is the reality like the story? Why does Jesus think that the story about the widow and the judge tells us something about our situation before God? Well, Jesus' logic simply is like this. The unrighteous judge said yes. So clearly the widow was right to keep going back to him with her cries for justice. Well, in an important way, our relationship with God is like her relationship to the judge, as strange as that may seem. But in fact, God is much more certain to say yes than the judge was. Therefore, we should keep going back to God with our cries for justice. But that still leaves us with the question, why? Why? He's saying that there is this similarity, but why is there a similarity between them? Well, I think to understand that, partly we have to go back to the context that I was talking about at the beginning. Let me remind you of what I think are some crucially important things about what's going on around and in this story. Before he tells this parable, Jesus starts out by telling his disciples, "The days shall come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it." Then he tells them, presumably the disciples that he's been talking to, a story so they will not lose heart. He concludes by telling them, "Shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night?" Well, we remember that the prophets and the apostles alike say that it is the coming of Christ to establish his kingdom that will finally bring justice for God's people. And there's also a strong theme in the Bible of God's people crying out for that day to come, and yet it still has not come. And then Jesus concludes by saying, "However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?" So, putting all of those pieces together, I would argue that Jesus is not talking about God answering any particular sort of prayer, that is, anything that I might ask him that I particularly want. Jesus is talking about God answering our cries for vindication, for justice, and ultimately such prayers can only find their answer in the second coming of Christ. I am crying out to God to do what he has promised to do, to make the world right. This, then, is how our situation is like the widow in this story. Like her, we have been asking and asking, and yet we have not received. We long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, but it's not here yet. Jesus himself reminds us right in the story, God's people have been crying out to God day and night for justice. And the implication, when you look at what he's saying, is God will answer their prayers, meaning he hasn't answered them yet. He will not delay. He will answer them speedily, but it implies he hasn't done it yet, which is exactly the picture that we see in the Bible and the world around us. The world goes on, and God's chosen ones suffer in this world. Injustice is done. Those who are in the wrong often win. Those who are in the right often lose. There is suffering and injustice all around us in our own lives. You may not go through your life day by day thinking, "Oh, I need justice. I need everybody to get what they have coming to them." But there is a sense in which all of us, in the people that we deal with and in the world that we're living in, are living in a world where right is not prevailing. And we suffer from that. Jesus is urging us to make the same sort of decision that the widow did. In the face of our need and yet what seems to be the delay of God in ultimately answering our cries, he's urging us to keep on praying and not lose heart. That is, he's not saying, if you want something from God, keep bugging him. What he's saying is, God has promised to make things right. But the question is whether you're going to believe him and to continue to go to him and ask for those things, or whether you're going to give up on him and say, no, in the end, I don't think there's any point in going to him because he's not coming through. Now we can see clearly why Jesus chose an unjust judge as the main character. His point partly depends on the differences between the unjust judge and God. Look at what Jesus says. Listen to what the unrighteous judge said. Now shall not God, and then he goes on. If this unrighteous judge said yes, then what shall we expect God to do? The judge is specifically painted as an unrighteous judge. He doesn't care about what's right, and he doesn't care about people. But in Jesus' description, God is distinguished from the unrighteous judge. Clearly, God is righteous and cares about what is right, and it is his chosen ones that are crying out to him day and night. These are his people. So whereas the judge had no interest in what was right, and he had no interest in the widow, God, to whom we are calling out, cares more about what is right than we do, and he cares deeply about us because we are his chosen people. So if it was appropriate and right for the widow to keep going back to a judge like that, how much more does it make sense that we should keep going back to the God who has promised to do right and who cares about right and who cares about us? So that's what Jesus is getting across to us here. Don't give up on God. You are tempted to do so because things are hard and things go on, and then they go on some more. But don't give up on him. Keep turning to him. He ends with a warning. When the Son of Man returns, that is, when he comes as the fulfillment of God's promise to bring justice on the earth, will there be anyone left who is still expecting him? When he comes, will he find faith on the earth? And in the context of the coming of the Son of Man and the discussion about calling out for justice, it's clear. What he's saying is the coming of the Son of Man will be God's final and complete answer to all the cries of his people. But when he comes, given the fact that it is a time in coming, will everyone have given up? Will nobody be like the widow who keeps going back? Will everyone have decided there's no point and given up on him? Okay. My point then from this parable is that there is nothing in this parable that suggests that we have a technique for getting what we want from God. There's nothing in this parable that says if you have a particular problem, if you only go and ask him once, you're not likely to get an answer, but if you keep going again and again, you're more likely that he will say yes to you. That is not what this parable is talking about. If we look at the biblical evidence, the evidence would suggest that sometimes when people cry out to God and persist in their prayers, God says yes. And sometimes when people cry out to God and persist in their prayers, God says no. We can picture David praying and praying for the life of his son until his son dies. We can picture Jesus going back again and again to pray to God that the cup would pass from him, that he would not have to go to the cross, but in the end he had to go to the cross. We can picture Paul saying 3 times he asked God to remove the thorn in the flesh, and God's answer to him was, no, I have a purpose for this. There is a reason for this in your life. So there's nothing in the Bible that suggests to us that persistence is a guarantee that we're going to get what we ask for. But what Jesus is saying here is what we are called to do is to persist, to persevere in our faith in God. And if we persevere in believing that God is going to come through, then when the pressure is on, we are going to turn to God. God, I am in trouble. I am looking to you. Have mercy on me. Bring justice to the world. Make things right. And the logic of this passage goes beyond just the issue of justice to anything that we are ultimately looking to God to make right through the coming of Jesus in the end. Life is hard. It is pushing on me. What am I going to do? Am I going to cry out to God? God, I am looking to you for the answer to the problem of my life. Or am I going to give up? No, there's no point. God, things just keep going on the way they have. I don't think there's any point in me going to him. That, I think, is what Jesus is confronting us with here. I mentioned that my advisor told me that I should read this book and respond to what it was it had to say. In particular, he was pointing out that this book that I'm looking at talks about persistence in prayer and says that's not what the Bible is getting at. Well, the book starts out by telling this story about a woman who comes to him for counseling. Her best friend had been diagnosed with cancer, and so her pastor had set up a 24-hour prayer vigil for this person. For months, this went on. We're going to storm the gates of heaven. Cancer is from the devil, and we are going to not take no as an answer from God. We're going to keep going until God prevails over the devil and heals her from this cancer. This is God's promise to us. We have the right to go to him and expect that he will answer this prayer if we are persistent enough. Let's make sure that every minute of the day somebody is praying for this, and God has to respond to something like that. Well, you know how this story ends. The lady died. And the person who came to him, to this teacher, was her best friend. She had been praying. She had been fasting. She had been hardly doing anything for months except banging on the gates of heaven, demanding that God heal her friend. And he didn't do it. And so she's coming to him asking the question. She's teetering on the brink of abandoning the faith. And she asks him the question, in a battle between God and the devil, how can God lose? She doesn't understand. How can this be? Well, what I really like about this book is that after he goes through his study of the parable of the unjust judge, and maybe one of the reasons I like the book is that he agrees with me exactly as to what's going on in there, he makes this point. He's saying, look, her teachers were thinking that this parable promises us that if we go to God and keep going, that he will answer our prayer, and he should have done that. He should have healed her in that situation. But in fact, this parable is speaking to her situation. She cried out to God for healing for that person, and she didn't get it. Things shouldn't be that way. Her friend died, and it shouldn't have happened. The question is there any point in going back to God anymore, in looking to him to solve the problem of my life when he didn't come through for me there? And in fact, the message that Jesus is giving in this parable is actually speaking not to the prayer that she was praying for her friend who had cancer, but to her situation. Am I going to keep praying to this God? Am I going to keep looking to him, given that things are still, this is still a world where your best friend can die, and God doesn't do anything about it. And now, if you want to talk about it, there's a whole other list of things we could talk about as well that are not the way they ought to be. What Jesus is doing in this story is reminding us, look, what you have to confront is the character of God as he has made himself known. He is good. He loves us. He has made promises. He does not make promises that he doesn't keep. So if I remember who it is that I'm dealing with, then it makes even more sense for me to keep going back to him than it did for that widow to keep going back to that unjust judge. But it all depends on not a technique to coerce God into giving me what I want, but for me to remember who I'm dealing with. This is the God who loves me and who cares about what is right. It is appropriate for me to keep looking to him because in the end, he will keep the promises that he has made. However, when the Son of Man comes to fulfill all the promises that God has made to his people, will I be expectantly waiting, believing that Jesus, in fact, will keep the promises that God has made? And I think that's what Jesus is calling us to in the parable. Okay, so we have a few minutes then for any questions or comments that we may have.
That last thing you said kind of makes me remind me of something that I agree with. I found today that a lot of people don't want to really deal with people. They just want to find, you know, places they can put little niches mm-hmm. in. And do you think this is kind of what Jesus is saying, that, you know, we need to really learn the character of God, not little techniques for dealing with them and little...
His point is mm-hmm. that we need to invest ourselves to stand on the rock of what we know about the character and faithfulness of God. I guess I'm the one who's making the contrast between the way that people have taken this parable and turned it into a technique. So yeah, I agree with you there that these... using these kinds of passages in that way can be a way of sort of taking, you know, what do I do with someone who's dying of cancer? What do I say to them? It's a lot easier to be able to say, if you do these steps, then it'll be okay. And of course, if it doesn't turn out to be okay, then it was your problem because you didn't have enough faith or something like that. So yeah, this... what Jesus is saying here is calling us to more to face into reality about the difficulties of this life and the faithfulness of God in a way that I think those other things, you're right, they can make it so we compartmentalize things in a way that we don't really have to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, that's not exactly what I meant.
Oh, that's not what you meant. Okay.
Well, no, you hit on a lot of it, but I mean, like, for instance, it would be like if I could take a marriage situation here and say that one of the spouses recognizes a problem, and instead of like speaking directly to the spouse, we'll like, oh, if it's a man, look up in all books about women, and men look up all books, I mean women look up all books about men, and approach it that way instead of going directly to the problem and, you know, looking at the relationship and the personality of the person.
Well, yeah,
I may be
I agree with that.
Track.
I think that's right. I'm not sure. You may be seeing a connection to that from the parable that I'm not seeing, but I like that. What you said, that seems good to me.
I'm trying to think how someone like the lady who goes and prays for her friend with cancer, how this applies to her. I'm trying to put that together in my mind. So would you say that, like in the case of a prayer warrior, it's right of them to keep going back to God and asking for, I mean, everything that comes their way, like be it little or be it big, just keep going back to God and asking for those things, but recognize that what God promises is justice in the end, not that God is going to fix each one of these little things along the way. So
yes.
So the prayer warrior is not necessarily in the wrong for praying for all these things that come their way, but they must recognize along the way that they're not necessarily going to get all of them answered, that what God has promised is that Jesus right. is going to come back and restore right. justice.
It was not my intention to turn... to do a series on prayer here, but since I've talked about these two parables, I've decided that it makes a lot of sense for me next week when I come back to try to talk about how do these parables fit into our overall picture of what prayer is, and that. So I am going to address that next week.
Right.
But let me just say that one of the keys to us, I think, is one of the examples I gave was Jesus praying in the garden. That there are many situations in life where it is appropriate for me to go to God and ask him for help. And if the troubles remain, to keep going to God and asking for help is an appropriate thing as well. It can it can be a sign of, I really think you're there. I believe that God is there and I trust him, and where else would I go with my trouble? But the model of Jesus in the garden is, not my will but yours be done. He knows that he has no promise from God that he's going to avoid the cross. And in fact, I suspect that he's pretty convinced that the answer is going to be no, that he's going to have to do this. But he goes to him because he's troubled, and he goes to God because that's the one he would go to. So yeah, in principle, there's no problem with the repetition of some prayer. If I'm ill, to keep going to God and ask him to grant me a longer life, there's nothing inappropriate about that. What I'm concerned with is the way these passages get turned into, basically, by saying it's a technique, it gets turned into a promise that has not been made, that if I am fervent and I keep repeating myself, that I am quite likely to get the answer yes. And that's what you see in that environment. I mean, one of the stories that the guy in this book tells, another one is, the guy is a pastor, and he has a 12-year-old kid who is dying of leukemia or something like that. And the people in the church, they're committed to this idea that they're going to pray and this kid is going to be healed if they have enough faith. But the kid is not getting better. And finally, the elders of the church come to this pastor and say, we've decided that the reason your kid is not getting better is because you don't have enough faith. So what we want to do is, this elder here is going to go in to the kid and he's going to lie on top of him to block him from your unbelief. And we're going to pray again, and this is going to solve the problem. And the pastor very rightly stands in the doorway, I think, to his kid's room and says, get lost. At which point the answer is, okay, well, your kid's going to die and it's your fault. See, it's that idea that we have been handed this tool that if it doesn't work, the problem is that we're not using it right. That's where these kinds of parables can be taken, and it's just, I think, a real misunderstanding of what Jesus is getting at. The reason that we can be confident that God will answer our cries for justice is that he has promised that's what he's going to do. But he hasn't promised that I'm not going to die of cancer or whatever might happen. Each of us has our own story. Some of us will have a long life. Some of us will have a shorter life. That's all a part of the way God is telling the story that he's telling. But in the end, anyone who wants God to rescue them from the deep problem of death and sin and futility and injustice that they face in the world will find that deliverance and will prosper eternally. So in that sense, to call out for those things is a prayer that cannot help but be answered. And that's, I think, the difference. We might have time for one more, if somebody...
It's kind of emotional to talk about this, but okay. I think in light of some of the things that Tuck and I have been through lately, I'm just so surprised by people's response that somehow the justice God is going to give is what they want or what they see as being the justice. Does that make sense? Okay. Meaning not dying of cancer. Oh. Or people would come to us and say, you know, we're praying, we know that God can heal Coco in the wound, and that will happen.
Right.
It didn't happen.
Right.
And so, you know, it's so interesting to me and something that I think will be the lifelong question of how to respond to that kind of a faith which says, I arbitrarily decided that this is what will happen if right. I pray for you.
Right, right.
And I don't know if they would know that that's what they're saying or that's what they're communicating, but it can be really unhelpful.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, in our quest as Christians to say, what is it that God is truly saying when he is saving us? And what is it that we truly will get at the end of this road?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a very good point and a hard question. I mean, I don't have a good answer myself as to how to respond to that sort of thing, because sometimes it's just coming from, I think, just a naivete about, I mean, we're told that faith is good, and we're in an environment where we're taught that what faith looks like is believing I'm going to get this thing that I want to have. And so we think, well, that's what we're supposed to do. And so it's not, I think ultimately it's not a healthy thing, but it doesn't reflect that fundamentally there is a disbelief or a hardness of heart toward God. But I think a hardness of heart toward God can manifest itself in this sort of thing, where fundamentally my attitude is, the reason that I like following God is that he gives me what I want. And if he were to ever turn into the sort of God that didn't give me what I want, then I would stop following him. And that is a very dangerous thing to place to be. And so it's hard to know whether, in dealing with people, should I just be, you know, should I just kind of let it go by, or should I try to say something that indicates maybe there's another way to think about it? Those are hard questions, I think. But yeah, it is, and it's not helpful. It makes it more difficult. I think many people have faced, I mean, like in that story that I talked about with that pastor, the people came to him, he ended up leaving the pastorate, and I think I would have too if I were in his spot. So, yeah, that's good. Okay, well, we'll stop there. Thanks, and I'll try to kind of wrap some of this stuff up next time.